Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
So in the history of unique double acts, we can look at Mulder and Scully, we can look at Sonny and Cher, we can look at Holmes and Watson, Spock and Kirk, but probably the 21st century equivalent has to be Brakefield and Burkey. Yes, of course, Charles and Roxanne, who are joining us now, authors of the week from cyberspace in all manner of wonderful things. It's a privilege to have you both on board from Texas. How are you?
We're good, Alex. Thank you.
Excellent. Roxanne, if we can come to you first. I said almost obviously partnerships and authors can work together and there are a whole range of historical precedents with respect to that. What was it that kind of led you in terms of this Enigma series that's so fascinating that you've put together as a series of texts and narratives, certainly from the technological world?
Oh, Alex, that's a great question. So honestly, what happened was at one point in time, Charles and I worked together writing technical manuals, and that's possibly the second most boring thing outside of watching paint dry. So, you know, that wasn't something that would sell or have fun, but because we were in technology, you know, we thought we'll take that technology and then, you know, we'll just kill people and not go to jail. So that's what we did.
Well, there you go. Spoken like a true Texan from that point of view, arguably. No, let's move on. Charles, I mean, technical journals, of course. I mean, you may recall the classic line from Montgomery Scott, who said, "It'll give me some time to touch up my technical journals." Trouble with Tribbles, I think, when he was actually confined to quarters. Right. Was it a similar journey for yourself that actually there are only so many tech guides you can actually put together before you think we need to do something different?
Well, what happened was that you spend, 3 to 6 months assembling a powerful story, how to migrate, how to do this, how to do that. And as soon as you launch it, it was out of date. And so if you'll notice, all the technical manuals always have the second, third, fourth, and so forth releases, trying to keep it relevant and germane to the field. So it was unsatisfying. I'll just be blunt. I mean, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm glad there's people to do that because I read technical manuals all the time. There's always something that's coming down the pike. And Roxanne and I have developed this this knack for being able to look at something and say, you know, if we distort this just a little bit, we can make another great story with it. So that's kind of the charm that we have when we pull in the technical facts baked into a fictional story.
Well, it's the official lives always write about what you know. And when you bear in mind that you have an appreciation of World War II history, travel, cultural exchanges, wine tastings, winemaking, Harley Davidson riding, cooking extravaganzas and woodworking, I suppose it gives you a fair amount of bedrock to actually work from.
Agreed. I mean, that's there's a lot of things that we get to practice on. Sometimes we'll do our cookathon and we'll stroll off into conversations about, okay, here's what happened on the Eastern Front, and here's what the this meant, and what if they had just changed it? And we do a lot of what if, and it percolates. And so usually in the morning, she'll get up early and go and use the four most terrifying words in her vocabulary: "I have an idea," and start putting it down on paper.
There is, of course, that argument about technology, that how do we know that we're simply biochemical machines that are kind of relating to each other? And, we're, you know, what is real? I mean, here we are in a Zoom room, which if you talked about this in even the 1990s, people might actually have said, no, it's just far-fetched, etc. I mean, Roxanne, talk to us about your own involvement and pathway across this technological from fact to fiction approach.
Well, so that's the really exciting part about putting technology as a foundation in our thriller series, is because we have almost an endless supply of new technologies coming down the pike that we can take advantage of. You know, Alex, we started out the first story really focusing on identity theft, which is a huge reality for everyone. And as we go through all of the different phases of technology, everyone is a foundation for a threat in one of the books, including things like, you know, ghost code, which goes onto a machine and destroys all of the valuable goodies and files that you have saved, all the way to cryptocurrency, or artificial intelligence. So it's an unending supply of thrills. And because we work in technology, it just makes it easier to transition into that story.
Let's bring in our ace musician here, singer-songwriter Chloe Rose. Chloe, we've talked at length about how you obviously have a writing partner. You collaborate from that point of view on your records and your music and things from that point of view. How dependent are you on technology for, in a sense, your singing career?
Oh, massively. Honestly, if there was no technology, it would die a terrible death. And that's because obviously everything now, it's more digital, especially even recordings. And and you need recording equipment to write the songs to put the music out there. So Alex, I'd be devastated. What would I do?
Clearly call on Charles and Roxanne to actually write an Enigma series about that. I mean, Charles, that whole routine and the way in which a musician is dependent on technology, is that something else you've considered?
Actually, there's a interesting treatise going on about being able to use artificial intelligence with deep learning, and being able to build stories, music. And David Bowie actually did in 2016 a release using an artificial intelligent application, built a an Audible, and basically it was a symbol for him, and they started shopping it, trying to see, okay, see this what this is what can't happen. This is where we as human beings start to feel threatened, because like, wait a minute, wait a minute, I don't want a machine doing all my stuff. I'm sure Chloe wouldn't want to have the machine say, thank you. I can take it from here. I'll be the hero for this particular piece of music. So we're very, I don't know, cautious when we do some of the stuff, because some of the things that we've written about, postulated, have come true, and that's kind of the spooky part.
Oh, can you tell us? Is there anything you can tell us that you've written about that's come true? Sorry, I'm quite intrigued by this.
Okay, so in book number 10, we start off on the, on a rampage, that's what I like to call it, on cryptocurrency. And
Yeah.
we it was just about the first part of that year, March, we had most of the draft done, and we had postulated that Venezuela, their government, their economics, everything they had done was going to probably implode if they didn't do something like introduce cryptocurrency, which they did in March of that year. And so it was like, whoa, I wish we had got this book published just a few weeks earlier, so we could have bragging rights on saying, see, well, we see the future. So it's kind of a fun drill. But those are that one, and we've had a couple of other examples where ransomware, the super ghost codes that that we looked at in book four. These are all things that were, again, we've taken the technical possibilities and then put them on steroids to see how they behave, and then the story and the characters kind of carry the day.
Oh, I
See,
find it all very interesting.
for the benefit of the radio listener, I'm not at all worried that I'll be replaced by an avatar, because who knows what could actually happen. I've just replaced myself there. Singularity, what's that? It's going into a whole new world. Kathy, questions or thoughts from yourself or either Roxanne or Charles or both?
Yeah, absolutely. And for both of you, because you guys work in such an interesting field. And I mean, you get to write about it and you've predicted the future. So I guess this kind of ties into that. Because I think the biggest or one of the many issues that's kind of coming up with new technology is how do you create law for a technology that is developing, which may not be existent today and tomorrow? So I guess I wanted to take your input on what do you think is going to have to change legally with the development of the technology we're in today?
You know, it's very interesting that you pose that, Kathy, because machine learning and artificial intelligence is something that people struggle with, because you can teach machines to do certain things, but you can't necessarily teach them the moral high ground. And so it setting up guardrails is something that we actually exhaustively discuss in two of our books, the latest two, And it starts out with who won the AI wars in the Enigma Beyond, because if you have someone who is a developer and just really enjoys watching technology create wonderful things, you know, you can create wonderful things, but if your intent is not wonderful, then there's going to be a bad side to it. So it's not something that you can necessarily lay laws down on unless you want to restrict people from having the ability to do something. So it's a very, very fine line. And you have to go back and hold the individual creators responsible if their technology goes awry. And I think that's a very difficult law to put into place, or legal system to put into place. It is a great conundrum that I think, I don't know that the technology leaders can make those choices without you know, a human input to it. Social media is a perfect example today. Social media has very few guardrails in it. It kind of goes off on its own tangent. You don't know what's real. You don't know what's done by a quote unquote bot. So it's very hard to get real information. And so I think that's part of where we need to start.
I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, that's something we've seen, I mean, throughout history with any new technology. I mean, that's kind of the irony of books. We don't consider them technology, but they were once a huge technology and they're still being burned today. And that's like one way that we handle it. So it's interesting to see when things start getting more technically advanced, how are we going to handle it as people?
Yeah. Roxanne, I mean, you have another connection, of course, with technology going slightly awry, or maybe going one of both ways, basically, because I believe your stepfather was a metallurgist who worked on the Manhattan Project during World War II.
That's very true, Alex. He did. And, you know, it was an experiment, and he talked about it greatly to see how things could be done, but nobody knew what was really happening to it. You know, no one knew how volatile some of these things were going to be or what it would take to get it done. And when you're part of a very large group, which is what he was, part of a huge group that worked on the Manhattan Project, your small contribution, you really didn't know what it was going to do in the very end. So I think that there was a lot of interest in the discovery, interest in saying, can we do this? Can we make some of these things happen? And then, oh my gosh, we made some of these things happen. You know, it's like anything else. You don't know the negative side or the potential for downside until you figure it out.
And we see a lot of that, those implications, folks. When there's a lot of times with, I'll be in a lab, I'll be looking at some of the advanced research, some of the interesting things that are being built, you know, the fusion reactor there in southern France. And I always have this same question that pops in my mind. Let's go see if we can do this. But they always forget to ask, should we go do this? So that's where the breakpoint is for most of the technical issues. And that's where the bad guys, the cyber thugs, the cyber trash, they show up and say, yeah, why not? Let's just go ahead and do this because we're not sure you can catch us anyway. You don't even know who we are. We're anonymous. Aha. You know, it's the what we like to call the Jesse James theory. So long as you have a flour sack pulled over your head, you can rob anybody and get away with it because they can't figure out who you are. And that's where the accountability comes into play for the technology that's being built. You see this a lot in the cryptocurrency wars that are going on right now. You know, there's something like 3,000 or 4,000 cryptocurrency versions out there. And now the newest weakness for them is the exchanges. Okay, I need to convert this currency to that currency before I get it into something else. And that's where all the bad actors are playing. So back to, should you have done this? Is this, was that the right move? Because you don't have everything thought out and what you're learning in real time. That's the horrible part, because you know, there's people suffering from some of the poor decisions and the not looking ahead far enough to be able to see, here's what, you know, to Kathy's point, you know, what should be done. That's a great question.
So you may recall when you were, you know, younger and in school, you may have been dared to do something. You know, I dare you to XYZ, whatever it is. So, you know, you go to college and they dare you on these computers to make a program or to break into this or to do that. And I remember some time ago, inadvertently trying to connect online and actually ended up where I should not have been in a business and backing myself out. And I actually wrote them a letter and said, hey, you know, you need to put some security in here to do this. But I wasn't one of those who was going in and trying to do it on a dare, but that's what a lot of these kids do. And colleges alone locking down their internal systems so that the students don't break in, that's one of the biggest problems they have. And so you take that and you go, okay, now I've got the mindset that I want to be naughty, or I want to steal, or I want to be lazy, or I just want to do it. And that clouds what that person does. And so, you know, you have a whole group of young people that are, you know, they're just making out very well, breaking into things. And if it doesn't work, as Charles was just saying, no one knows who they are because they know how to anonymize themselves, and they just walk away.
It's a fairly dystopian picture that you're painting, which probably has its echoes and roots in William Gibson's cyberpunk writing, and maybe arguably the Wachowski's notion of the Matrix, in which we're probably all just acting as batteries for the machines in any case. I mentioned the singularity beforehand, and this time where effectively the machine has taken over or will take over, and artificial intelligence reaches the stage where effectively it controls this biological life form that we refer to as human beings. Is that something that keeps you up at night, Roxanne?
Oh, you know, I honestly do worry about that. And I think we have to be smart enough at some point in time to pull the plug, because that's about the only thing we have right now to control. Every device we have depends on power. So if we pull the plug, cover up the solar panel, if needed, you know, we actually can take some of that back. You know, it's even like Chloe and her music. Charles was saying, you know, we have machines that are going to create music or write books or do all of these things. I will maintain that the human creativity is stronger than we can make any machine to be. The individual is far more imaginative than what you can build into a machine, in my opinion.
Charles, do you share that thought?
I'd like to believe that. We're back to that question. You want the red
the
pill or
half,
the blue
full,
pill?
Half
okay,
empty, isn't it really?
Yeah. The red pill or the blue pill. I mean, okay. Which way do you want to go? Yeah, I like to believe that. I'm also a bit jaded because I've seen things that should not have occurred. I mean, military drones infected with software that just to see if they could do it. I've watched hacks coming in through at a consulting doing a consulting gig for a large automobile manufacturer. They shut down. They got through the walls. They permeated the network, and for 6 weeks, it was nothing but clean up, fix everything that had been poisoned. So, and that was some of the handiwork of the North Koreans, the Lazarus Group, to be specific. They're a fun bunch. They don't have any scruples, and whatever is poisonous is fine with them. And so long as they can launder the stolen cryptocurrency that they pilfer from all the different exchanges, I guess life is good for them. I think it sucks to be them, but that's just me. So.
So we look at the geopolitical situation in the world today. You've got China and Taiwan, you've got Russia and Ukraine, you've got issues relating to democracy and free votes and empty votes and no votes whatsoever. Is this all just a situation whereby there are mischief makers afoot? That is it all part of the Enigma challenge that effectively, you know, we're faced with all this wealth? It's almost this tsunami of technology that kind of just overwhelms us insofar as we need it. What we're doing now is making use of technology. We're connecting Lincoln with Texas, with Cleethorpes, with all other sort of aspects. And yet somehow we feel as though we're kind of out of control. And there is that concern that even if we switch it off, we're not sure whether we're still not out of control.
Well, we're probably too in too deep to turn it off. Let's be honest here. I mean, this, how much good stuff goes on? I mean, a lot of the
I think
imaging
this
in
is fairly good
hospitals.
stuff, Charles, the author of the week feature. I think it's fairly good.
So there's plenty of good stuff going on. It's just that, the things that get distorted from over-reporting of here's all the bad stuff that's going out. Everybody should run. Don't believe anything. This information source is no good, or it's sort of good because I like it, but I can't prove it. So the disinformation is probably the next big hurdle for humanity. And the reason for that was is that I mean, back in the 1500s when they said, okay, we're going to do printed books, and this is the final word. Well, there was an oral tradition leading up to that, and then there's something was put in place, and this is now the final word. And now you can't find the final word. The stuff that I work in, telephony and global communications, there's stuff that's I'm struggling trying to keep up with. They're changing this and moving that, and here's some of the other pieces to go along with it. And all of a sudden, it's like, how does anybody keep up with this? Who has a complete grasp of everything? And that's a real tough question to be able to try to answer, because there's, if you look at all these folks that are out there, like Roxanne, myself, we have a piece of that knowledge, maybe a larger piece than somebody else, maybe a smaller piece than somebody else, but trying to assemble all of it into a coherent explanation of where are we going, and what is the broken pieces, what are the things that are that's a shame, or that's like, oh, this is good, follow this, and on until the wheels fall off. That's the disinformation piece that we're seeing. That's really a hard one to defeat. How do you do that? And that's probably one of the next topics, one of our books on how to be able to get in and distort and manipulate people's thinking.
Well, the Enigma series, which is sort of partly talking about today, obviously comprising the Enigma Rising, the Enigma Factor, the Enigma Ignite, Enigma Always, Enigma Wraith, Enigma Beyond, and Enigma Threat, many more, of course, available for it from that point of view. Kathy, let's move back to yourself again. If you had a chance to actually have a look at the websites that we shared prior to the session, enigmabookseries.com. But any thoughts or questions you'd like to put from thence?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a topic that I could talk forever about, but I guess what I
Us
wanted
too, us too. Yeah.
I guess what I wanted to ask you guys is when it comes to, because I think you bringing so much life into these stories and so much of a reality into these stories. And I guess the question or the lesson we should be taking from this is this something that should be addressed or fixed by individuals, or should it be on corporations that this should be kind of addressed or fixed upon? Or is it a little bit of both?
Oh, Kathy, I think it's a lot of both. I think individuals have kind of given up a lot of things to other entities. Parents giving up teaching their children to schools rather than being responsible for setting those boundaries and setting those guidelines. And here, we're going to give you a device at the age of 6, and that way you can go ahead and stroll the internet. And yeah, we won't put guardrails in there. Don't you worry about it. You just go ahead and search to your heart's content. And there's a lot of things that may not be good to expose young people to until they have a good foundational frame of reference. Should companies go the same way and maybe, put warnings out where they need to help? Sure. I think that there is a partnership there to do that. But I think individuals, to a degree, have to be taught that they have a responsibility. So if an individual is taught to have a responsibility, then they carry that forward in what they do. But if they're not taught that, then they run wild. So I think it's both, but the individual is key. And I think that it's important that we recognize that and we support one another in wanting to do that. And it's not I'm not trying to be political. I'm not trying to be any of those kinds of things. I think as a human being, we have to be accountable. And that means we got to know right from wrong.
Right now, there's a real thrust in the investment financial markets of ESG, you know, and environmentally secure governance is the I think that's probably not correct, but it's ESG investing, and people are starting to question some of the motives of the corporations. The corporations are saying, "Oh, I'm being called into question for my ethics." Gee, so I think that there's some give and take. There's some yin and yang, if you will, thought processes of the individual needs to have question what their employer is doing. The employer needs to be able to say, are we giving back to the community? Are we being responsible, or are we just dumping plastic trash into the riverways, and make sure that the quarterly profits look good. So to your question, Kathy, I think that would be it's incumbent upon people to ask those questions. And to Rock's point, if we've not educated our young people to be able to question, is this the right way to do it? Is this ethically sound? We're going to inherit something that we're not going to like at all.
Can we? You also teach. Just so from your own perspective, Chloe, as indeed Kathy's taught as well, I obviously teach as well from that perspective. What's the kind of sense with the teenagers you teach drama to? Are they locked to their mobile phone? If they had their mobile phone taken away from them, would they be completely lost? Would they be hopeless? Would they have nervous breakdowns? What's the situation?
Well, a couple of months ago, all hell broke loose because the school decided that they was going to ban mobile phones as soon as the first bell goes, and then they can start using them again at the end bell, when school finishes. And it was because we were getting some kids filming other kids, putting it online, and obviously you've got that, responsibility to protect and things like that. But I honestly think that they would have a meltdown if they couldn't use the phone all the time, because it kicked off massively. They were like, why aren't we allowed to use our phones at all? And I understand their concern about wanting to speak to parents and things like that at lunch, but I think some of them were just bringing it into the lesson, which isn't good. But yeah, nowadays it's very much technology, isn't it? So I think they would struggle a lot.
And I don't think you can learn in 240 bits the things you need to know to take yourself through life effectively. You need good teachers like you but you are
very
creative,
kind.
And so you have a frame of reference to share with them, but it's not necessarily something they're going to find only on their device.
Yeah.
It's from your experience, and it's more than just, a little 10-second video.
And Kathy, same question to yourself. I mean, obviously you've taught English in Australia, and you've traveled the world from your original base in Miami. What have your experiences of the whole technology and the next generation been?
Oh man, I mean, we need another hour. But it's funny because I worked with adults. I occasionally it would be teenagers, and it's impressive because my reflection is very similar to Chloe's, where adults act like children if you give them the opportunity to. I remember
how
my
TikTok
first...
succeeds, of course.
I mean, my first year teaching, I was responsible of teaching a movie class. And it was a very simple concept for, especially when you're learning English for a second language. You'd watch like 15, 20 minutes of the movie. There's discussion questions based on those 15, 20 minutes, and you're supposed to discuss. I remember the first class, I put on the movie, I turn off the lights. The first thing that happened, everyone goes on their phone, like lights reflecting back on them. And we're talking about people between the ages of 18 to 30, who everyone in the class did it, to the moment where I was like, I paused the movie 2 minutes in. I go, what's the main character's name? No one could answer me. And that was the first day I had to implement, we're going to put the phones in this bin, my phone included, so we can focus. But there's also opportunities where I loved using technology in the class. I've taught a whole class where you had to tweet throughout the process to summarize and to do things. So it's like, I'm not against or for or anything like that, but there are times and places, and I think we very easily forget how easy and complicated life can be with or without technology. And it's the responsibility as well as the teacher's responsibility. But just to kind of remind everyone, we need to be able to do this either way. You know, that's the whole point of survival.
Yeah, we have a sequence.
So good.
We have a sequence in one of our books where we actually, I guess it was in book number 10 or 11 or 12, where the main supercomputer that's part of the R group, Ichabod, and he's sort of there. He's always helping with the classroom, and Quip basically is teaching, and the kids are doing just like Kathy said. You know, like, okay, why are we doing this? You know, and they have a range of you know, from like 10 to 18, and the instructor challenges, who did the homework? And the two youngest ones raised their hand. Yes, we did. And the other two is like, why do this? I can have a computer do this for me. And we have that concept, that discussion. And you know, the instructor says, okay, if you guys didn't take the didn't do the homework, we're going to have a test. I'm going to have a competition between my supercomputer here, Ichabod, and the two young ones who did the lesson. And so you guys raise, he puts the equation up on the board, he goes, solve it. And of course the kids are just, you know, blah, 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 you know, just, you know, really hammering out. And they get to the end and said, okay, done. And he says, okay, give me your answers. And they put the answer from the supercomputer up on the board. And he looked at the other two and he said, which one's right? And they went, well, the supercomputer, because he's a computer. He always does that. And he goes, no, I gave him the wrong answer to put out so that it would look like you were the two young ones were wrong. They followed the equation. They knew how to use the theorem to be able to answer it. So the lesson was, if you don't know how to get the answer using the technology or without the technology, how do you know you're being lied to? How do you know the answer was any good? And so in an algebra class, I had Mendes instructor. We were terrified of him. But he said, you can't use the theorem until you prove the theorem to be able to solve the algebraic equation. So like, I learned that way back about years ago. And it was important lesson to be able to say, how do you know you're being lied to if you can't do it yourself?
We're going to have to listen to one of Chloe's musical numbers, The Sky Is Falling, which I think sort of sums up the whole notion of how everything sort of can collapse on us and all sorts of things. So here it comes.
What reflection do you see?
End of our Author of the Week feature, we have the fabulous Charles Brakefield and Roxanne Berkey with us. We've been talking about the Enigma series. Roxanne, in terms of accessing it, would you suggest there's an origin point, or is it a case of just dive in? It doesn't matter which one you go for, go to enigmabookseries.com and I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
Well, you know, honestly, each book is written so it can be read and enjoyed individually. But the characters do evolve and grow over the entire series. So starting with book one, you learn the foundation for some of these characters, and they do mature and they do, you know, see different things. And one of our favorite characters that Charles mentioned a little while ago, Ichabod, perhaps has the greatest changes of all as his supercomputer technology grows and expands over time. So I think anywhere works, but start with one and read them all.
And is there any connection between Ichabod and Ichabod, of course, from Sleepy Hollow, I should say?
No, actually, what that is, it's we have, in our world, we come up with acronyms all the time, and sometimes they're absurd. To anybody listening, like, it's not like you're speaking in tongues. And so we poke fun at ourselves. Ichabod actually is an acronym, and it stands for Immersive Collaborative Associative Binary Override of Deterministic Systems. So
that sounds like an ostrich, an outrageous suggestion taken readily in courageous hands.
That's right. There is on the website, Alex, there is a free download that people can get of the specialized terms that we have, which is the acronym FUN from the series. So that's certainly a fun place to start. And each acronym appears in a certain book, and that's referenced there as well.
Well, I certainly enjoyed the Welcome to the Enigma series intro by Petra and Jacob, which I thought opens up a whole range of things. And I can pretty much guarantee that, as far as I'm aware, no artificial intelligences have been harmed in the making of the last interview. But it does actually take us round to those two final questions. And I'll ask Kathy to do the first one and Chloe to do the second. Kathy, would you like to put the first question to both Roxanne and Charles, please?
Of course. All right. So, Roxanne and Charles, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us today?
Yes.
That's a good one. You had to think about it there, Roxanne, didn't you? You know, there's a pause there for customer satisfaction.
Was it reasonably
people would have said,
interesting?
Yeah, you were reclaiming the whole conditions. It's a customer routine. We could say smiley face, happy face, sad face. It's all in the feedback. Charles, what about yourself? Has it been okay for you?
What was the question? I have an attention deficiency.
Have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today?
Okay. Yes. Absolutely. I like the perspective. I like the juxtapositions. Anytime I get to listen to myself talk, I'm enthralled. So thank you for that.
So it's a five stars, Kathy. To be honest, you know, five stars or more.
Let's go to Chloe then. What's the final question? Go for it, Chloe.
I'm interrupting. I'm ever so sorry. And will you both be back to join us again? Will you be returning?
Oh, hopefully soon. This has been a fun group. I really enjoyed being part of this, I don't know, amazing discussion. And I love variety. You guys are super.
We like talking about our work, and we try to get as much words in, as many words in as possible. Well, so,
as I said at the start, Charles, Mulder and Scully, Sonny and Cher, John Steed, Emma Peel, Brakefield and Berkey, it's all putting in together. Charles Brakefield, yep, and Roz Berkey. We haven't even had a chance to actually talk about your upskilling of sort of furniture and indeed your skeet shooting, but that's another thing for another time.
Another time. Absolutely.
And Charles, take care.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've just seen the kind of inspiration that can be provided when you actually have success to the fore. I'm thinking, of course, of that fantastic European Championship victory for the Lionesses. But what about setting up your own business? It can be equally challenging in a whole range of ways there. And one in three prospective female founders feel that confidence is a barrier to opening their own business. So to talk us through this and maybe expanding on how people should maybe take that leap of faith, we're delighted to welcome the managing director of not-for-profit Virgin Startup. That's a wonderful Andy Fishburne. How are you, Andy?
I'm very well, thanks, Alex. How are you doing?
Good. But a little bit disappointed that here we are in the third decade of the 21st century, and it still seems as though the notion of a shy, retiring wallflower and actually not sort of engaging with business, it's all about the confidence. Sometimes you have to take that leap of faith, don't you?
You absolutely do. And I mean, there are so many incredible and inspiring examples of women that have built incredible businesses. And, you know, arguably, it's easier now to start a business than it's been at any point over those last 30 years. But what we're looking to do is to encourage more women to want to take that leap of faith and to start and scale incredible businesses. And, you know, for us, we launched something called our 50-50 Pledge back in 2019, which was designed to help level the playing field for women that were starting up. Because currently in the UK, only one in five startups does have a female founder. And the further you go on your funding journey, you know, by the time you get to kind of later stage investment and you're talking about venture capital, only one pence in every pound goes to a woman founder team. And that's something we think should change.
I mean, it's interesting in terms of the age difference, really, that the under 40s are much more likely to want to run a business that can have a positive impact on the world, with a fifth of those saying that they'd look to make the world a better place for their business. It all leaves a kind of notion of that legacy, really, that you want to ultimately leave the world in a better place than you perhaps find it at present.
Absolutely. And I think we're seeing that in, you know, kind of consumer habits and, you know, trends at the moment in general. You know, people are more aware of the businesses and the brands that they spend their money with. People are more aware now of issues around sustainability. And we're seeing kind of people shop and spend their money differently. And that invariably filters down to businesses. So people are wanting to combine kind of purpose with profit and build businesses that have a positive impact on the world, for sure.
Returning to that opening headline that a third of women, or one in three women, say that they lack confidence that would obviously stop them from starting a business, it's substantially different from men. It's only 18% of men who say the same. Is that due to just education? Is it the fact that we still haven't, despite the rhetoric to the contrary, dealt with the notion that actually our school systems don't necessarily prioritise the importance of confidence and actually taking those leaps of faith?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, Alex. And I think, you know, for anybody who's starting a business, whether you're a man or you're a woman, it's a big step, particularly when you're doing it for the first time. And I think what's really important is that you kind of surround yourself by the right people and get access to the right support. And, you know, starting a business can feel really daunting, but you don't have to build a big business overnight. You know, you can start where you are and do what you can. And taking those steps kind of helps to build that confidence. But what we see for women founders in particular is that they quite often don't have those kind of connections or that network around them to get the support that you need in those kind of early stages to take those first steps and to start to build that confidence for yourself, which is why at Virgin Startup, we match all of our founders with business advisors to do free business advice up front to help you turn that idea into, you know, a viable business. And then for every founder we fund, we match them with one of over 600 volunteer mentors around the country so that everybody has access to the support that they need.
That aspect of obviously having a mentor who understands the challenges that can be encountered when you're actually setting up a business, I would have thought that seems to be essential in terms of obviously ensuring that people are effectively coached into a situation of actually beginning to fulfill their potential.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, you're absolutely spot on. And we carried out some research recently with 250 small business owners in the UK. And what we found is that 90% of them had actually received some form of external support. And 75% of them had had mentoring. And everybody that had said that it had been an advantage to them and to their business. And that kind of experienced mentorship, someone who's kind of been there and done it, someone who's independent and objective, can be an invaluable sounding board. They can provide you with, you know, really important kind of business advice, but also kind of personal advice and emotional support as you go on your business journey. So surrounding yourself with the right people is absolutely key.
Is there ever a good time to set up a business? I mean, there are people who would actually say, yes, you should actually wait until we actually get into a full-blown recession and then set it up. Or no, you should set it up now. Or is it a case of, look, just do it, set it up and see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to be involved with Virgin Startup now for almost a decade. And we've worked with, you know, tens of thousands of people. And the one thing I've learned, and I'm absolutely confident in, that the best time to start a business is now. There will never be a perfect time. And what we found is that actually when people take those first steps, when they put something out there into the world, it's incredible what opportunities come off the back of that. And you start to think about your business idea differently. You start to spot opportunities yourself. People kind of approach you with things. You can reach out to people for support. And the single biggest barrier that will stop someone from starting a successful business is just not starting. And, you know, it's a little bit of a kind of cliche, but this idea that, you know, the strongest businesses are built in the hardest times, you know, also has a huge element of truth in it. And the last couple of years, I think in particular, have been very difficult for everybody, but for small business owners in particular. But what we've seen is people, you know, have launched in lockdown, they've gotten creative in a crisis, and they've found opportunities within things that have been happening around them.
The old Napoleonic statement that Britain was a nation of shopkeepers initially springs to mind. But presumably in terms of the idea for a business, that is the critical aspect, that when it comes to obviously the accountancy, the ways in which those things can be applied, there is help on hand for that. But nobody can actually take away that original idea, and having that right idea at the right time presumably is also critical to the success of women in business.
It is. I mean, but the thing I would say, you know, above all else, that you don't need to have, you know, an original idea. You don't need to be the next Facebook. It doesn't have to be something that no one's ever done before. I think what it needs to be is an idea that you care deeply about. It's something that you're passionate about and motivated, so that in 2-3 years time, you're still going to want to wake up in the morning and go up and do that for yourself. And being your own boss and building your own business can be incredibly rewarding. It'd be fulfilling kind of like personally. It can be fulfilling, you know, financially if your business is successful. But what really underpins that is having an idea that you're motivated to want to work on and are really, really passionate about is absolutely key.
And where can people actually go to find out more details about Virgin Startup, Andy?
So the best thing to do, Alex, is to head across to our website, which is virginstartup.org. There you'll be able to find out about all of the support that we provide, from free business advice and access to funding, mentoring, masterclasses, events and more. You can also read about, you know, various different case studies of founders who've been there and done it. But you can also find us on social media as well. So across all of the main platforms, including TikTok, you'll find us at Virgin Startup.
And allowing for, obviously, the importance of inclusivity and diversity and so on and so forth, do you get a general sense that we are approaching equivalence in terms of male and female, or is it a case of it's an ongoing challenge?
I'd say we've made great strides. So, you know, I mentioned that stat earlier that 1 in 5 startups in the UK has a female founder. Off the back of our 50-50 pledge, 46% of the founders that we fund are now women. So, you know, a material improvement on what the national average is. And there were things like the Rose Report that the government commissioned back in 2019 that, you know, identified that there was a £200 billion pound opportunity for the UK economy for advancing women in entrepreneurship. So there are lots of different kind of initiatives and programs out there now that support women in business. And it's just about encouraging more women to take that first step and to build a business on their terms.
Absolutely. Who knows? You could actually have a very lucrative business on the back of the success of the Lionesses. I'm just saying it's a possible idea. I could put it out there. Andy Fishburn, MD of not-for-profit Virgin Startup. Huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thanks for having us, Alex.